last Sunday and the previous Sunday, I returned to my annual Easter message, doing it in two messages. But I do not want you to fail to see how it fit in Romans 1, 21 and 22, which you again have in front of you. Having known God, not as God, they glorified Him, nor thanked Him, but became vain. We've analyzed that word. Evil, self-deceived, self-exalting, self-centered, self-wanting, emptiness, because it's focused on self, and they become empty and evil like this in the reasonings of them, it says. Notice that word, dialogismos. Little Greek word, dia, through or by means of. And notice that the next part of that word, if you're looking at the papers I handed out, dialogismos, notice, let's put it in English letters, L-O-G, or L-E-G. Remember that root? From which we get logos, from which we get logic, and illogic, from which we get the opening passage of John. In the beginning was the Logos, and the Logos was with God. Logismos has that same root in it, logis, but the root is longer leg. Now, we spent a lot of time on that, particularly back when we were teaching through the Ephesian letter, where God has, as part of His name, when it reads, translated, blessed God, it's not something we are giving to God as a blessing. It is not us saying, bless God. Unless you're saying it in the way that you would say Jehovah Shalom. It is an intrinsic part of His nature to bless. And the means of blessing, eulogia, same from which we get eulogy, is that His method of blessing His people is by words. And by words of the nature embraced in this ancient root that took two pathways. It came to be word and to choose, because it was an act of choosing out from among other options and doing it with words. That's what God did when Paul says He chose us before the worlds were formed. And I've often used the poetic phrase, He whispered your name before the worlds were formed. God chose, and I remember spending weeks on that passage in Ephesians before I felt the conscious awareness of the congregation. Because I know how people listen. It's like you think I'm going to kill the cancer before it kills me and misunderstood what I said. It took a long time for me to feel the wave of understanding to go across the congregation to where you could really grasp. God called before the worlds were formed, out from among those that He did not call. And now we're in Romans 1, where those that have had exposure sufficient from the creation to recognize God exists and is the only adequate answer, and thank Him and worship Him in this wondrous universe that we have been given the capacity to explore, and the one who created this playground for the intellect is thrown out of the garden, and he's mad, madder than hell about it. And he takes from mankind a faculty, the faculty of God sense. He takes it from them until their senseless heart is darkened, and professing themselves to be wise, they demonstrate themselves to be fools. And I showed you that last Sunday and the previous Sunday. There's only one Christ of history, but no other one to be found. If you're going to be honest and create a Christ of your own, be my guest. You can create Christs of whatever shape, size, and form you want. But there is a Christ of history, and the only one found there. And I've taken the giant step. I said, show me your source. I got an undergraduate history major. We subject it to the normal historiography tests. In that source that causes people to say he's good and wise because of what he said and did, he's going to be making such ridiculous claims about himself, he's either a nut or a fraud, because only God can make those claims, not a mortal man. And therefore, either decry him as a nut or a madman or a blasphemer, as the Jews did, at least the leaders in that day, or dismiss him from honored status among the world's respected founders of religion. But they won't do that. They, in the name of intelligence, sophists, become morons and tell you to believe Jesus is a good and wise teacher when they don't know anything about him. On every other subject, they will not speak unless they've looked at the evidence. But on this subject, they become fools instantly. There is no other option. He's not a good and wise teacher. He's either God, and then he is good and wise, making these ridiculous claims that only a God can make, or he's a nut who believes the impossible, or a fraud capable of making others believe what he knows better, cannot be claimed by mortal men. Sophists who become fools tell you a good and wise teacher. Sense taken from them as the eternal Logos moves on the stage of history that was in eternity facing God, could tell us all we need to know about God, struck a tent, turned from facing God and struck a tent in human flesh to bring that blessed word from God right into the stage of history. Dismissed as unworthy of a look and lacking the courage to relegate him to the refuse pile of nuts and frauds, claim to be presenting a Jesus they can respect as a good and wise teacher while they deny the very claims he made about himself. Likewise, last Sunday, the resurrection. It's sophists, men who claim to be wise, who have become fools, that come up with these crazy explanations for the preaching of the resurrection, unwilling to accept the fact of the miracle that vindicated his claims. They come up with the craziest explanations, and through words, through dia, logis, words, which are ways of choosing out from among other options, they choose the moronic in rejecting the truth. And when that happens, God turns them over, takes from them the faculty. They couldn't make sense about God if they tried. We have gone on a long journey of science in this vast magna universe and the equally vast micro-universe. You want to take a hydrogen atom? Imagine that it is a pea, a little round green pea, in the Vatican, in its most vast domed area. And the little speck, about 1/2000th of the mass of the proton, the neutron that makes up the hydrogen atom, about 1/2000th of the mass of the nucleus, and it's floating around up here in the highest regions of the Vatican chambers. So they're not room in this vast cathedral for the distance between the nucleus of the atom and the electron, that they don't even know what it is. I don't know whether it's a particle, as all your science books tell you, going around like our planetary space, or whether it's just a cloud, or whether it's waves, like when you take a rope and it's tied and you send the waves along. You ever notice there's no half waves? You ever held a rope and just sort of made it? Not many of you ever done that. Held a rope and sort of made it flow and undulate like waves. There will never be a half wave on the end, whether it's 2 or 10. They will be perfectly distributed. They come, you don't ever hit the end of the rope with the peak of a wave. You ever notice that? I bet you didn't notice that, did you? How many did notice it? Now, whatever these electrons are that nobody knows, waves, particles, clouds, they used to think that they were like shells, and as you increase the agitation with heat, they'll jump to the second shell, and jump to the next shell, and jump to the next shell, losing energy all the time, light goes out, and then when the agitation or heat or light on it is taken away, they start jumping back. And sometimes they take the quantum jump, which is what brought us into the slang. They jump over one of the layers. Now, I don't know whether it's layers or not. So in essence, they don't know what's out there and they don't know what's in here. It's all theory. Everything is theory. Nobody's ever seen an atom. We know the galaxy is exploding in every direction, getting faster as it goes out, but somehow in total slowing down, which is a paradox in itself. And from anywhere, there is no center. It's all going every direction. And out there in the furthest reaches, they are telling us all these things by analyzing the red drift in the spectrum of light that tells whether it's moving toward us. We now know light bends. The Lorentz trace distance between 2 points. We now know that space is suddenly undulating like laying a bowling ball on a waterbed. Come on back. We know that when a light leaves a distant star out there and comes to the sun, we are looking in one place, and when the light left, it's left from a different place and it's being bent. We know that light through space does not just travel through a vacuum. Neither is there such a thing, though they're starting to return to it with Higgs boson of ether. But it's not just empty space. And it's like going like an ant crawling on this waterbed with 3 or 4 bowling balls laying on it. Now the ant, so small it hardly is aware of the undulations. But it's not going in a straight plane. Now, all of this leads to a question that ought to at least include God. For years, Newtonian physics ruled everything was eternal. It somehow identified with their thoughts of the infinite and the eternal, so the world always was and always will be, and everything has no beginning or end, which is anti-biblical, by the way. But along comes the scientific development culminating in Hubble's work that the universe is expanding and at mind-boggling speeds. And they can calculate the speeds. And therefore, if they can calculate the speed that got it out there, assuming that everything has always been at the same rate, then they can work backwards when things were once closer together. And they come to the Big Bang, which we've been talking about. And the Big Bang at least supports a beginning. And we're back to St. Thomas Aquinas, prime mover and first cause, and who was the Big Banger? Because they go to those first seconds as they go back and trace the reverse of the speed of what's happening now, assuming things have always been the same. You go back, a round figure that's generally agreed on, 15 billion years ago. That's a lot of years. And from a white, hot, incredible, gaseous, incredibly dense contraction of the whole universe into the size of a pinhead or less, this incredible heat and the gaseous cloud around it makes it impossible to apply any of the laws of physics past and beyond the first few seconds of the explosion, because it's completely blacked out. Nobody can get to this white-hot center of the explosion. They don't know what caused it, what happened, but there was a beginning. Boom! Romans 1:22. Here's a relatively new book by Robert Jastrow. New and expanded edition. God and the Astronomers. I'm going to illustrate. All of this preaching is just to teach one thing. I'm denning it in. You trifle with the knowledge that God has given you at whatever level. It's almost as though I could say, it might be better off. I'm going to be ludicrous. Well, I'll just be personal. I cannot tell you, as I gained in the knowledge and skill of sin. No, that's not what I'm going to tell you. But I cannot tell you how I wished I had not been born a preacher's son. I mean, I traveled around the world. Man, I saw unabashed natives. They were as guiltless as Paul talks about those that without the knowledge of the law, there's no knowledge of sin. They're just unabashed enjoyers of sin. Well, now, I enjoyed my share, but I always had this cloud on me. I knew it was sin. I could have been a much happier sinner if I didn't know I was sinning. Are you on a page with me? Now, God is not, I'm going to tell you, it's a misquotation when it says God no respecter of persons. The hell he ain't. I hated Paul through my college years. Now I live to preach what he taught. I hated him. I struggled with faith. Man, I wish I'd have had my cancer miracle when I was 17. I wouldn't even have bothered to study the resurrection. That would have made an instant believer. I envied my dad. Paul couldn't help me. I've gone through this repertoire with you more than once. If God, while I'm trying to destroy people and fighting against people that worship Him, and God shines a light out of heaven, knocks me off of my animal, and speaks a voice out of heaven rebuking me, makes me blind, tells me to go to a place. The irony of it is I'm blind as a bat and I'm to go to a street named Straight. God's got a sense of humor. I mean, why not send him to a street called Stumbling? I'm too blind to walk straight. But he sends him to a place in Damascus he's never been. And there's a guy there scared to death of him, because God has to talk to that guy too, because Paul's out to kill everybody that's a Christian. And when he gets there, this guy, because God talked to him, tells Paul all about Paul, lays hands on him, opens his blind eyes, and then Paul testifies to resurrected appearances of Christ. If that had happened to me, I wouldn't be laboring with my faith. I'm like Thomas. Always have been. I had to take it step by step. Oh, I had them all tell me as I'd grown up, "Well, you just got to have faith, Gene." Yes, I can read, I can hear, I can understand. Without faith, it's impossible to please God. How in the hell do you get it? Well, now I know. Faith comes with hearing, hearing with the Word of God, but, you know, they were trying to give me faith like you give an injection of penicillin or something. Doesn't happen that way. Exposure to the Word, the living Word that I taught last Sunday, to the reality of who He was and the claims He made about Himself. Exposure to the evidence of the resurrection. I had to work at it. Jesus just appeared to Paul. Well, He's a respecter of persons too. He called your name before the worlds were formed. You are responsible for the knowledge you have of God the instant you get it. And at that moment, a war begins. And some of you think you can trifle with the knowledge you have. You can be like the prodigal son. Just wave it off. This pause of many messages on Romans 1, 21 and 22, and it will continue, a trifling with the knowledge that you have, as we'll go in the second chapter and see, God's going to judge you by the knowledge you have. He's not going to judge me by your knowledge. He's not going to judge you by my knowledge. We are responsible for the exposure God has given us, starting at the lowest level, simple exposure to the creation. God expects response. And if you don't give Him response, His wrath hits you now, and you become fools because the God sense is withdrawn, and no man cometh to the Father save the Spirit drawing. You can't trifle. That's what I'm saying. And these people, Darwin was married to a Christian wife. I've already told you Albert Einstein, as a 13-year-old, stood outside while his two friends were converted in the Billy Graham meeting. And he fought Einstein. His own theories forced him to the position that there had to be a beginning. It was the application of Einstein's laws, mathematically, that set the stage, brought forth the propositions, and subsequently forced the conclusion of a beginning. Somewhere back there, a beginning. He didn't want to accept it. He resisted his theory for years. Shortly before his death, he told a visitor he finally accepted the idea of a beginning. But he fought it. I'm going to quote some others here. A little humorous remark. Someone asked St. Augustine what God was doing before he made heaven and earth. And he replied he was creating hell for people who ask questions like that. That's not what I'm reading this for. Many, this is wise, but absolutely incapable and resisting the idea of God. That's the point of these verses. They have the God consciousness, the God-growing mechanism withdrawn because the faculty was not exercised when God's presence was revealed in some way, starting with the creation. Eddington, scientists will know these names, wrote in 1931, I have no axe to grind in this discussion, regarding a beginning and the Big Bang versus the steady state of eternal reality. I have no axe to grind in this discussion. But the notion of a beginning is repugnant to me. I simply do not believe that the present order of things started off with a bang. The expanding universe is preposterous, incredible. It leaves me cold. The German chemist Walter Nernst wrote, quote, to deny the infinite duration of time would be to betray the very foundations of science. End quote. Philip Morrison of MIT said in the BBC film on cosmology, quote, I find it hard to accept the Big Bang theory. I'd like to reject it. Alan Sandage of Carnegie Observatories, who established the uniformity of the expansion of the universe out to nearly 10 billion light years, said it's such a strange conclusion, it cannot really be true. That's closed mind from those who created the tunnel that worships open-minded seeking of truth. Everywhere I've turned in these messages, I am pointing out a missing gear. I told you this story many times. The same man that I read for in college, head of the history department, taught general world history for years. I'd go to him and ask him a question about a little controversial issue regarding the history of the Civil War. He said to me, Gene, I'm not an expert in the Civil War. Charlie Scott's the U.S. history expert. Go take that question to him. I respected Lou for that. Lou Oliver, head of the department. I respected him. He wouldn't comment in his area, especially, on an item he had not personally researched and looked at the evidence and the pros and cons for. Yet he would give completely and totally sounding as though they have all the authority of his vast historical knowledge. He would tell me that the Gospels weren't written until 2nd, 3rd century. He would tell me that a belief in miracles is a result of oral imaginations exaggerated with time. Of course, at the graduate level, I took historiography from him. And I saw he was just parroting the standard textbook in those days by Johnson on historiography that just parroted the liberal viewpoint of higher criticism that swept across Germany several years earlier. He hadn't looked at the evidence, but he would speak on religion even though he hadn't looked. The Opportunity is there. They won't look. As R.C. Sproul says, atheism is a state of mind. They do not want to accept a master. Now, with all of that, I'm cutting new ground now. We're moving toward the theories of man's existence and Darwinism. And I've hit a few of them, the Piltdown Man hoax and some others. But I'm moving toward that mystery we call life. And I'll probably end this series as I get into information theory and show that across the broad band of scientists, given the opportunity, they rule God out. Now, they have to. In order for Darwinism, I've changed the subject now, folks. I'm just illustrating in myriad cases the tendency to rule God out and then how stupid they become in violating their own principles. For Darwinism and evolution versus the biblical concept of creation out of nothing, the earth has to be billions of years old. Now, I have no trouble with the rocks of this earth carrying in them a record of billions of years. I embrace the cataclysmic theory and the vast gulf of time between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2. I have to, if I accept the Bible, concede from Isaiah and Ezekiel that Satan, who is called in other passages, created by God, with his pipes and tablets created in him from his beginning, he was the crowning cherub or song leader and song master of heaven in singing the praises of God. He was cast from heaven, not the future event, when Michael will cast him down again, and he's limited to this earth before being cast into the lake of fire. But a past casting down among the knowledge of eternity from the inside that two Sundays ago we were pointing out of the claims of Christ. I was present when Satan was cast down. A third of heaven went with him. And he's encountered after Genesis 1:2 as the opponent of God. But he's seen in Ezekiel and Isaiah in Eden before he fell. I don't understand the dinosaurs and even the uniformitarians that believe everything proceeded the same. Recognize there's been periodic mass extinctions. They claim the dinosaurs were made extinct about 65 million years ago by a great comet or asteroid hitting the Earth. There has been evidence of changed magnetic poles. And mass extinction occurred, and there are at least four others that people debate upon. Some saying there are five all total, some saying there's only the one, some arguing against even the dinosaur extinction. But the uniform idea is the Earth must be 4.5 billion years old in order for there to be enough time for evolution, which proceeds by mutations that are in the minority. Most mutations depreciate and make that which is mutated less able to survive. But accidents of a good mutation that creates a superior ability to survive creates this chance mutation. The natural selection, the survival of the best, proceeds along the route. And once this religion of Darwinism is embraced, and careers have been made, and Nobel Prizes granted, and textbooks written, and livelihood is tied up with it, much like I argued last Sunday that if the Jewish leaders brought the charges against Jesus, the issue of the resurrection was bread and butter to them. It wasn't. It was even life, blood to them. It wasn't just an intellectual pursuit. When men have gained their reputation, taken their position, and peer pressure for grants, for university posts, for acceptability for publication, which increases reputation, when that momentum begins to build, it becomes a religion. They cannot afford to be wrong. And all of a sudden, as you research, you find purely objective men like Lou Oliver, who won't comment at all on a minor point in Civil War history, because that's not his specialty, that would seek to wrest the faith from me, his, there's no humble way to say it, his best student, because he picked me as his reader because of the academic standing ahead of the rest of the whole department. And he could not stand the fact that he couldn't reconcile my academic performance with a belief in the supernatural. So he had to explain it, as I've told you, by finally concluding in an announcement to me that this was some vestigial emotional tie to my father. Well, thank God for precious memories. But that was not why I believed. But he shook my faith, and I took years building it back. These people, once they take their position on Darwinism, it's a religion, and they will not allow the thought to be contested. It is now a fact. It's not a theory. It's presented as a fact. Well, I attacked some of that earlier with the Piltdown Man and other things. I'll come back to it. But let's just talk about the age of the earth. As I said, I have no trouble at all thinking the earth multiplied more than 4.6. I don't care if it's 406 million. Doesn't bother me, because at least the earth is divided between pre-Genesis 1 cataclysm that must have occurred at the time Satan was cast down and the war was in heaven. There's some interesting comments after Genesis 1-2, Genesis 1-1, in the beginning, Big Bang or otherwise, God created the heavens and the earth. Genesis 1-2. And the earth was without form and void, the King James says. The Hebrew equally allows. The earth became a waste and a desolation. Jeremiah sees a prophecy, past tense, when the earth was fertile, there were, the King James translates, cities. The Hebrew is meeting places of intelligent beings. Not necessarily humans, because Jeremiah says of this past tense prophecy of the earth, there was no man. He then sees a cataclysm strike the earth. Mountains move. And he uses the same Hebrew phrase, except it's translated, the earth became a waste and a desolation. How much time between Genesis 1-1 and 1-2? I don't care. Don't know. We'll never look back and know. But there are some interesting phrases in the recreative period. First he says, light be. Now, I read a letter in some literature of some college student that decided that Genesis couldn't be accurate because he said, let there be light, and he called the light day and the darkness night. And this was before there's a sun and a moon, so that couldn't be true. Well, the sun and the moon are not the only source of light. And light, whatever it is, comes from God himself, and he just dispensed some from himself And I would assume that the earth was round then too. And there was a dark side and a right side, unless you've got some kind of God like a crab that's reaching around. You know, mixture of poetic and fact. Don't get carried away with literalism and don't get carried away with allegories. There are facts that are very clear. He said to Adam and Eve, replenish the earth. He didn't say plenish it. That means this earth had a life before this start over time. He created most things ex nihilo, as it said, from nothing. But he called forth from the earth vegetation and things that would have survived the cataclysm. There are all kinds of clues that tell you Bishop Usher was just looking at genealogy tables, and it is not necessarily Christian to believe that the earth has a 6,000-year existence. I don't care how long it existed, but something started over in Genesis 1-2. And a cataclysm occurred, and another cataclysm occurred in Noah's day. The Bible teaches cataclysms and cataclysms and failures and cataclysms and start-overs. Evolution teaches uniformity. No change. You got a geology column in front of you. You want to add this little book here, Richard Milton. Want to add a calculator? You look at that, and you notice certain common amounts of years are involved. But you add a calculator. I'll find it here in a minute. I'm going to say it now. If you add a calculator, there's great uniformity in how many years and how many millions of years go by in each of these ages. No geologist seems to have checked out, I'm reading from Richard Milton, no geologist seems to have checked out the geological column dates with an electronic calculator on a common sense basis. Look at the thickness of the rocks in each period compared with the length of time assigned to these periods. And I'm hard-hit. I sat down and did it. Note there's a remarkable consistency between assigned age and thickness of deposit. Now, I'm not too sure which one you're looking at because they ran out of one of the columns. But in any event, if it doesn't have these periods on it, then I'll hand out another one next Sunday. For instance, the Cretaceous period, it says to have lasted 65 million years. Is that what it says there, Gil? The Cretaceous period, 65 million years?
Yes, sir.
Is that what it is? The Cretaceous period is said to have lasted 65 million years and is 15,000 meters thick. At an average rate, annual rate of deposition, you come up with 2/1,000ths. Of a meter per year. Look at the Silurian period. This too yields an average rated deposition of about 2/10 millimeters per year, or 2/1,000 millimeters a year, as does the Ordovician and the Devonian and the Carboniferous and the rest. The thickness of a human hair per year. Go ahead and figure it out. I hate it when they're dealing with millimeters and meters. I hate that system. It's measured from the North Pole to the equator across the surface of the earth, which cannot be accurate. The inch, the British and American inch, varies by 1/2 a hair's breadth. From the pyramid inch, which modern science has discovered is the distance through the axis of the earth, from north to south, 1/500 millionth of that, which happens to be the sacred inch that produced the sacred cubit that was used by Solomon in building the temple, the Ark of the Covenant, And the Pyramid of Egypt, we'll get to that some other time. This millimeter French thing, I hate trying to calculate that. 2/1,000ths of a millimeter per year in each of these. They're all the same. That means uniformitarianism. I want to read to you again. The same figure will come out for the Ordovician, the Devonian, the Carboniferous. Each of these so-called ages have a deposit rate, because nothing ever has changed, that lays down sediments at 2/1,000ths width of a human hair per year. That would not cover a tadpole before something ate it. And yet we are expected to believe that dinosaurs and giant fossils, well, I'm dead now, and I'm laying here hoping the buzzards don't see me, because it's going to take about 50 or 60 years for me to be covered up. Professing to be wise, they become fools. How many of you have heard that radioactive dating is absolute? How many of you heard that? Huh? Now there's two kinds of dating. Radiocarbon, where the carbon isotope decays. And that has, I think, a 5,600-year half-life. So when half of it's gone, 5,600 years have passed. 56, 57, something like that. But radioactive uranium and its sister thorium and the companion isotopes. And isotopes are atoms that occupy the same place, have the same number of protons, same number of electrons, are chemically the same except they have extra or less neutrons. So you add up a number that uranium, for example, the heaviest naturally found until they started spraying man-made things on the earth. Uranium is 92 is its atomic number, the highest on the list. And its mass is considered 238, though nobody knows what mass is. It's taken from a constant arbitrary figure related to carbon, carbon-12. But uranium is shown in chemistry books like this. 238 is its atomic number, its mass number, and 92 is its atomic number. And that lets you subtract the protons. If we take the traditional idea, here's your nucleus and here's your electrons, and you have so many protons, like carbon-12 has 6 protons, 6 electrons, and the neutrons can be the same, or carbon-14 will have, instead of 6 neutrons, it'll have 8 neutrons. So you'd show it as C, 6, and 14. Same way here, there's a lot of neutrons in uranium, and it's radioactive, they lose them. And as these particles, because it's an unstable, as these particles turn loose, you have what's called radioactive decay. And uranium has a half-life of 4.6 billion years, or 5, something like that, 4.5 billion years. So, in theory, if you find 238 uranium, and its half-life produces 206, then you're going to have, say, half of it's gone. Say, a deposit, you find half of it is 238 and half of it's 206. I'm oversimplifying. Then you know that the 50-50 distribution means that rock 4.5 billion years old. You understand that? Now, that is true only if we know the starting point. That's true only if there's been a constancy. Nothing has changed to alter. Like if you're going to time something, you got to know when you start your clock. Or if you're timing by a candle or sand in an hourglass, you got to know how long was the candle when it started. Is it burning constantly, or like your clock, did the power go off while you were out and change something? Is it going to be constant? Third, no externals that would affect it or change the constancy of what you're looking at. But in all that, assuming that it all started at the same place, nothing changed, uniformity, half of the neutron decay has reduced the number of neutrons until now you have 206 instead of 238. And this is called radiogenic lead because it's produced by this decay and loss of particles. And common lead, also found in the soil, is 204. If my memory serves me right, but the principle I know is right. So you can distinguish between common lead, 204, and 206 radiogenic lead that has lost enough particles to reduce down from 238 to 206. And therefore, in the same deposit, you have the remainder of 238 in a lead deposit. And you have some 204, you might have some thorium mixed in, but you have 204, which is common lead, not radioactive and losing and decaying and remains constant. And you got a bunch of 206, and the percentage is unvarying. If it's 75%, 238, and 25%, 206, then a quarter of a life is gone. And the half-life is 4.6 million, so you divide that in half, and that's how old that rock is. You got me? Well, then you're really smart. If I erode to my belt, God forbid, but if I stand here and I erode half of my being in 10 minutes, and you're watching, and I just decay, and pretty soon I'm just sitting here on my stump, belt level, having lost vital parts of my body. Legs, for example. And I'm down to the knees. You know that half-life, I'll be cut clear down to half in 10 minutes. So if I'm only down to the knees, I've obviously been standing here only 5 minutes. Because half-life is 10 minutes. So I must stand here, if I'm on my stump right at the belt level, then I'm 10 minutes old. You understand? Assuming that I started out as a baby. I come out of the womb with a half-life of 10 minutes and I deteriorate by losing the cells of my body at the rate of half-life 10 minutes. Got it? Well, in 10 minutes, I'm a little baby stump. In 5 minutes, I got half legs. That's what radioactive dating is. It has found these unique qualities of uranium, and therefore, they're able to go out and build a geologic column. The Earth is not like an onion. You don't have all of these levels everywhere around the Earth, just like an onion. No, they find some rocks here. They find them up in the Burgess Shale up in British Columbia. They find them in other parts of Canada, China, Wyoming. Geologists, Australia, all around the world. They are finding these things. And they're dating them and they're sharing research. And they are starting out with the assumption. An assumption that things have always been the same, uniformly this earth has developed, things have always been the same, and we're finding rocks that decay, lose some of their particles, thus changing their mass, They lose some of their particles at a fixed rate, a half-life. Now, what happens, two things happen. When they lose these neutrons, another radiogenic lead is the product with fewer neutrons, but there's also a release of gas. So two things happen. A release of some of the particles through gas and a release of neutrons, and a new form of lead is being formed as a result of having lost part of itself and decayed down. Because you assume, starting point, how do they assume that? Well, there had to be a starting point, Big Bang or otherwise, when all radiogenic lead, radioactive lead rather, started fresh and new. Like me coming out of the, I don't come out of the womb by the illustration I used with the bottom of my feet already gone. I come out whole. So the assumption is this earth started with this lead, radioactive lead, being at zero. Got it? 238 is 238. Hadn't lost anything yet. You subtract the atomic number from 238, and you know how many neutrons are fooling around in that lead. But the minute that it comes into being, it starts this process of decay. So slow, it takes 4.5 billion years for it to reach half-life, where half of it, half of 238, is gone, and 206, it's assumed, has appeared. And gas has been released. Now, radiocarbon dating is much the same. We receive from the air two kinds of carbon. Carbon-12, that's fixed and becomes really the basis for all mass in chemistry and physics. Carbon-6. For carbon-12, with 6 protons, 6 electrons, 6 neutrons. Carbon-14 also is available. It has 8 neutrons. As long as any living thing on earth is alive, it's taken in both of these. But the minute you die, no more carbon-14. So carbon-14 begins to deplete. And therefore, if you know the moment of death, like a manuscript, we have papyri, which was living plants, and it's killed, and it becomes a manuscript, you only need a little piece of it. It's like DNA almost. Little piece. And you can then plot, because the ratio between C12 and C14 starts changing. And we know that half-life, 5,600 or 5,700 years. Now, both of these assume everything's always been the same. The atmosphere was always the same. Assumes an equilibrium in carbon trading that I'll talk about when I get on it again. That is 30,000 years it takes to strike an equilibrium between the atmosphere and the people taking it in. And since the Earth is already soon to be 4.6 million or 6 billion years, then the 30,000 is obviously passed so long ago that we have equilibrium and balance, but that's another subject. Always it's constancy, knowing the starting point, constancy, and no external interference. And on these two methods, half-life that proceeds at the same speed, we end up knowing that we're on safe ground. We have absolutely dated the rocks of the earth to when they first started to decay. We've absolutely able to date any product of life that partakes of carbon. 12 and 14, we know at the moment they died, so that marks an age. And this is absolute. Then they've expanded it now. I got a textbook here that's enough to commit suicide over by the fifth page. Principles of Isotope Geology. Brings back the horror of my years of doing a unit major in geology, getting ready for Cal before I went to Stanford. It's absolute, they say. And they go to potassium, argon dating, and all other kinds of half-life deterioration, the jumbling of these various isotopes and the various parts thereof. Well, okay, let me give you a couple examples, and then I'll quit. That ought to be good news on this subject. Let's take am I boring you? Let's take, which I haven't gotten to, but I can explain it next Sunday the same way. Argon, radiogenic argon, potassium and argon have a half-life dating method like this too. And that's what's used, by the way, to date those volcanic deposits where the Leakeys have discovered these 2.5 million and 3.5 million human fossils. Well, the same method, radiogenic argon and helium, contents of three basalts erupted into the deep ocean from an active volcano, you could do this better than me, Lahua, Kilauea, have been measured. Ages calculated from these measurements increased from the sample depth to 22 million years from lavas deduced to be recent. A similar study of Hawaiian basaltic lava, actually dating from an eruption in 1801 near Hualalai, came up with potassium-argon dates ranging from 160 million years to 3 billion years. In 1969, McDougall of the Australian National University measured the ages of lava in New Zealand and got an age of 465,000 years, whereas the carbon dating of the wood included in the lava showed it to be less than 1,000 years old. And I really like this one. They found a painting in Australia, and they dated it. Oh, you'll love this one. They dated this painting with radiocarbon techniques, and it was millions of years old. Oh, come on, Scott. It's in this book. Maybe I should just go and read it to you next Sunday. Anyway, they were making a big thing out of this. And I even wrote that down on a yellow page. Well, I'll just tell you. They dated it millions of years old. And as they were parading it, proving Romans 1:21, sophists who become morons, as they were parading it, a woman in South Africa recognized it as a painting in her art class that she had painted that had been stolen. This was the most ancient painting of fossilized man. And then there's the fish that walked. The missing link, finally, when fish crawled out with their flippers and got on the land for the first time. And it was heralded as the missing link between fish to amphibians to us, eventually. Until they're trolling off the coast of Madagascar, and on a deep net, they pulled one up a few years ago. The living fossil that wiped that one out in one fish net. Now, I will show you next Sunday What Professor Cook showed about radioactive dating. And I will show you next Sunday about radiocarbon dating, also by Professor Cook, who proved that these conditions cannot be defended, who proved that the so-called age of the earth can be stacked by the very process itself. Who, in, to just pick one case in point, thorium is a sister to uranium, 90 on the atomic number scale. It produces a particular kind of radiogenic lead, 208, I think it is. It doesn't matter, I'll chart it out for you tomorrow. Or next Sunday, that's the way my weeks go by, or 2 weeks from now, if you haven't forgotten it. 208 can only be, it was thought, produced by the decay of thorium. The two largest deposits of lead in the world that have the largest accumulation of 208, so-called radiogenic lead from thorium, have no thorium in them at all, which is, I think, 232. But those figures can be checked on any periodic table. So thorium with 232 combination of protons and neutrons decays to 208, if my memory is correct, and 238 uranium decays to 206. The two largest deposits of lead in the world have massive amounts of 208. Massive amounts by the normal relative figures, and no thorium. How did it get there? Since thorium is supposed to be one of those rock-ribbed ways in which we date the age of the earth. And the two largest deposits in the world have massive, by the relative measurements of combined isotopes, they have massive amounts of 208, which the radioactive dating method requires would come through the half-life of thorium, billions of years, and there's no thorium there. How to get there? I'll tell you. Thanks to Professor Cook. Because you see, some of these neutrons are moonlighting. They're moonlighting on other jobs and creating. 2 weeks from now, I'll tell you what they're creating. The point of this message is very simple, as with all the messages. They are so determined to rule God out of the equation that they will defend, I don't know when Darwinism will appoint a new Loyola. And I don't know when they will form a church and come out with a congregation for the believers in Darwinism, the protectors of the faith, who will have marching orders. They can't burn you at a stake anymore, but they can keep you out of universities and keep your work from being published. And as I said, there's a group of them on the internet now called the Howler Monkeys, who by sheer howling and yelling, monkeys defend their territory with screams that can be heard 2 and 3 miles away. And they've adopted the term to yell and put down anyone that challenges Darwinism. We're back in the Middle Ages with a new religion. And to dare to challenge these methods that require uniformity is to commit suicide academically in the tunnel that Houston Smith has described. Well, we're trying to knock holes in the tunnel with a sledgehammer, and 2 weeks from now, I will show you some more ridiculous situations of so-called acrid, radioactive, radiocarbon, and potassium-argon dating. They are not. They start on assumptions unproven, and they do not prove the age of the earth. And my position is, it might be older. But radioactive dating methods have been sold to you as perfectly reliable facts. They are not. Radiocarbon dating, used in one case to prove a false fossil that picked up, it was pure turkey. And they had to save face to say somebody must have been eating a turkey sandwich in the area. It is not reliable, used allegedly to disprove the shroud. When the shroud is contaminated wherever it was handled, in any of the years through the centuries, until you don't know whether they're taking a piece that has carbon residue affecting the dating that was put there, particularly since the shroud went through a fire, they come with these scientific credentials. When we speak, I've told you, don't ever marry one. They will tell you what went on in your body when it didn't happen. You understand me? But how dare you think it didn't happen? A scientist told you. No sound. 100 ears to hear it. But my engineer upstairs, the scientist, says we have sound. Because his meter said it. The earth is 4.6 billion years old. Because radioactive dating, radiogenic, the very words are enough to give you a mental orgasm. I mean, they've got to be right to use words like that. I mean, you even talk about an atom. You read the textbook, he starts out, and he's using 3 different languages before he's out of the gate. Isotopes. Isos in the Greek, same. Topos, place. I know that. Not everybody knows it. But they use isotopes, and they think you understand what they are. I asked Craig Lamb, PhD in genetics, how would you explain an isotope to an audience with 12-year-olds in it? Well, he says it's been 30 years. And it has, since he was teaching on the subject. Not easy. Because it assumes something. Occupying the same place on the periodic table, but with different neutrons. What in the hell did I just say? Scientists talk like that. And engineers talking XYZ and a B5 2478 XT pi 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 C. Interpreter, please. That's what has happened to this generation. I would have done it today, but I'm used up my time on other things. I want to poke holes in radioactive dating, radiocarbon dating, potassium argon dating, and all of these highfalutin fancy name things that tell me this is the absolute truth and the Bible couldn't be true. They are sophists who've become morons. And when I show you the gaps in their theory, they make a believer in the resurrection look like a hard-headed cynic. Do we understand one another? That's my message for today. Offering time. Remember, no service next Sunday here in the cathedral. We return to the cathedral a week from Sunday, May 6th at 11 o'clock. Make your reservations beginning today before you go wherever you're going. Also on May 6th, we return to King's House 1 for communion and what we've come to call the miracle service. Try not to lose too many neutrons. You understand?
Yes,
I hope you'll be here 2 weeks from now, because I really will enjoy knocking some cracks in these old rocks. I hope you'll be here. Take care of yourself and tune in occasionally and be watching next Sunday. You never know what'll play or what'll be happening. The song is "I Go to the Rock," sort of fitting, I think. We go to the rock you can count on, not these other not so accurate and countable and dependable rocks. They go to the rock. You guys do that well, but you learn precious memories by next Sunday, okay? I like that old song. Tempted to sing it again, but I won't. I go to the rock. Good day, folks.